Hi, this is Joe Campanelli, the host of In the Drink. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, buddy, welcome back. It's another gloomy Thursday in Bushwick. Yeah, 2 weeks in a row. Like, warm and raining and weird weather. Anyway, just give a shout-out to a restaurant I went last week after the show, Faro, F-A-R-O. It's the Jefferson Stop, L Train, Bushwick. Incredible restaurant. Really great. Husband-wife team. Super, super, super. I'm going to go back again. But I got to give them kudos. I'll have them on in December, I think, at some point. But the guy's nuts. He brings in all New York State flour, brings in his own grains, whole grains from upstate New York, grinds them in the restaurant for his bread, for his pasta. Makes his fresh pasta programs. He's got leftover egg whites. So he does a lot of baking of vegetables in a dough you make with egg whites, salt, and flour. That's just crazy. So, I mean, eventually, like, the whole place was great. And the wife's in the front of the house. I love that. We've got a great show today. We have three guests in the studio. Alice Firing is going to be my first guest. We're going to talk about nothing but natural wine. What else would we talk about? And then I've got Chef Ali, Alessandra Altieri, who is the – I'm going to, like, screw up her title. But she's, like, basically the head – baker person for all the Bouchon bakeries in the country. And we have two in New York, and they're amazing. I remember when the Time Warner one opened up, like, wow, finally, like, a great bakery. Like, a real, like, it's Thomas Keller opens up, like, a retail bakery, seriously. It's so good. And they've got one in Rock Center and Vegas and Cabo. Anyway, she's going to talk about what it's like to juggle all those balls and how she got in the business, because she's a great story, too. And then I've got a restaurateurs coming in. They're there now, but they're going to be my last guests because they're late. Gianfranco Florentino and his chefs from Il Gatto Pardo and The Leopard will be the third guest. So we'll talk about wine, pastry, and restaurants in that order. Alice, always a pleasure. So let's give a shout out, because you, I mean, I've known you over the years because you've written how many books?
Oh, God. You know, I always say I've only written two, but when I think about it, I've written four, and by 2007, it'll be six.
Okay. But that's right.
At this point,
2017.
Four. Yeah.
Yeah, because you've got one. We're not going to talk about that yet, but we are going to talk about that at some point, because I heard rumor of that.
Right. We can hint about it, but the Georgian book comes out in March.
But you've had a newsletter. So let's shill the newsletters. Talk to me about how people can find it. Because, you know, I mean, you could buy these wine magazines. Who does? I mean, honestly, I guess people read Wine Spectator. They must. Or Parker, but he's not really involved anymore. But that's like whatever. Or then you can just, I guess, Food and Wine is what's-his-name writes for them, and then Letty Teague writes for the Wall Street Journal, but yours is great. It's a point of view, and you've been a proponent of natural wine since Jump Street.
Yeah, there are kind of pathetically few wine magazines in this country, and you get way more in Germany and England and France, for God's sakes, Italy. But here, there's really, for an independent voice, there's pretty much nothing. Blogs, there are blogs, but those aren't magazines. There's Punch online. They do drinks. But yeah, I feel like there's nobody doing what I'm doing.
How do people find out about your newsletter?
People
Where do they go?
People go to my website. So you go to Alice Firing, A-L-I-C-E, FEIRING.com/newsletter, or is it slash? I can't remember. Or just Google Alice Firing Newsletter or TFL.
It's great. It's so good. It's so good. And just to tease you, Thanksgiving's coming up next week. Drum roll. Blah, blah, blah. So in your most recent newsletter, you have, and I love this, you have like 20-some wines that are under $20, or like from like 13 to 22. I don't even know what this cap was, mm-hmm. but the criteria is my price range. That's the criteria.
Exactly.
For people like us to drink wine every day, yeah. The good news is in New York you can go into stores like Flatiron and Chambers and others, and there's a plethora of great wine, mostly from Europe, in that price range. It's superb.
Mostly from Europe. Yeah.
Mostly from Europe. But you've got these great profiles of the wine, great descriptions, who the importer is, sometimes who the retailer is. In the case of Chamber Street, sometimes it's the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And they're great, great wines, interesting choices for Thanksgiving. So that would be if you went today and signed up and got the newsletter.
Exactly.
A good reason.
Yeah, this was my second annual Econo Plus issue. And I started last year because, I don't know, did you notice this tremendous price increase in wines last year?
I noticed, like, my favorite, like, I was at the Gamay Harvest in 05, and I've been a Beaujolais Cru proponent forever. And I used to, like, I mean, kudos to them, but it used to be, like, the high end was 18 to 24 to 25. And now it's, like, 25 to 40. I'm like, what happened? The euro's gotten like you know, what's going on here?
That's exactly it. The euro has gotten
weaker,
and our wine prices have gotten stronger in this country. And I just kind of threw my hands up, and I realized a few years before that, just 2 years before that, I was asked by the New York Times to do a list of wines under 11, and I said, not going to be able to do that.
That's so tough.
Can't
That's
do
really
it.
Tough.
Give me 15. And so they gave me 15, and I realized I could not do that today, what I did then, and it wasn't that long ago. So I said, you know, to hell with this, 20, let's go for 18 and under, and really making it tough for me. So really, the cutoff point is $18, and I was really pleased with what I found, and I did bring my cheat sheet because
we're going to talk about it, and I knew you were coming. So last night, I had a bottle of wine. I had a quick dinner, had to go out, and I was having fish, and I have, like, a refrigerator full of wine, and another, like, I have more wine than I don't know, I have too much wine, and I should just drink more. Anyway, it was, how do you pronounce this grape? It's a Georgian wine. Chardakhi.
Okay, well, that's the region.
That's the region. Rkastsitel.
Well, Roccazzatelli.
That's the grape?
That's the grape. Yeah.
And it was Iago's wine. And
how
I guess
did you get the Roccazzatelli? I haven't, he only does that. Wow, how did you get that one? He really makes, primarily makes Chianuri. He does make a little bit of Roccazzatelli, though.
Don't ask me. I don't keep notes on where I buy them. But I shop. I mean, it's either Chambers, Flatiron, Manhattan Wine Company, sometimes Jean-Luc Leduc. So it's one of those four suspects.
Okay, because he mostly makes Chianuri. It is about 45, about a half an hour outside of Tbilisi, of course, unless you've been there. These cities mean nothing
to me. And you've been six times.
Yeah, I've been six times.
Because they've been making wine in Georgia since, like, the beginning of time.
Yeah,
it's probably
exactly
some of the earliest winemaking on planet Earth.
Exactly.
And what killed me about this wine, so it's dry, it's white, it seemed like it was probably bio, although I can't say it didn't seem like it was played with much. I'm not sure if it was sulfured at all. But the thing that was, like, floored me was, like, mushrooms. And I don't mean truffles. I mean, like, mushrooms, like champignon or prairie. Like, it smelled and tasted like mushrooms. I'm like, that's crazy.
That's crazy.
I know. But then I read someone else's tasting notes. Like, I went this morning, I'm like, Googled it, because I'm like, this is nuts. Why do I keep getting it? It wasn't one of those phenolic things that blew off or disappears. It was just the whole bottle of wine was this distinct around everything else, around the sort of minerality, and the fruit was just mushrooms front and center. I'm like, that's crazy. Talk about how he makes his wines.
Well, Iago is the very first certified organic producer in Georgia, and he's actually the very first garagiste or independent winemaker that is a full-time winemaker in Georgia. So that's pretty exciting, and he's a fantastic guy. Now, how does he make his wine? Very traditionally.
He uses these creative things.
Yeah, very traditional. So he's going to use extended skin contact. Basically, you foot trod the grapes. The grapes flow into these buried amphora called quevri.
That's the word, quevri. Are these ceramic?
It's pottery.
It's underground, so the lid is on the top, and the rest of it's down, which helps for temperature control.
Exactly.
So the grapes go down there with the yeast that's naturally occurring on the skin.
Totally.
It's grape juice with the natural yeast, foot crushed, boom, 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 gravity fed in.
Yep, gravity fed
on,
in.
So it's on skin and leaves.
On its skin.
On close leaves.
For I think he does 6 months of skin contact. And then it is siphoned off. Into really, really scooped off, put into another quevri, and then stays there till bottling.
And that's it.
Mm-hmm.
That's period. That's
incredibly simple way of winemaking.
That's cool.
Yeah,
it's really, really neat.
It really is cool. It really is. There is no sulfur except some sulfur to clean the quevri with. That was it.
So none for stabilization post bottling.
Nothing.
That's crazy. I mean, that's really. It's. But we've talked about that. We'll talk about that more and more. Tell me about, so among these lists of wines that you had for under 20, tell me about this one, La Colombière. So it's Fronton Reserve. What? Where? The grapes were Negrette, Syrah, and Cab Franc.
Right. So what do I have on that price? $13.
$12, I think. No, it's 2012. I don't know. I didn't write the price.
It was either $12 or $13. I was stunned by this wine. It got this at Chambers. It's a fairly newish winemaker, and they're making wine at just biodynamically, organically. I don't think they're certified in biodynamics. And the wine, it had searing acidity, absolutely amazing acidity. And I was a little confused by the acidity. And when I'm confused by a wine, it was like, it's so bright. And I never think of wines from Fronton as having that kind of acidity. In fact, because of the soils, which is very gravelly, they tell me that their wines usually have a very high pH, which turns into lower acid wine.
Right, think of clay and acid or other soil types.
Exactly. But they said no, and just this one they pick at the right moment, so they preserve the acidity. And I found what was shocking about this, what was intriguing, and then also very delicious, was this balance of this high acidity and very lush fruit, and an earthy, savory, rosemary, and wild quality that didn't quit. It had a very, very long life, this wine.
And those are usually things that you're not going to find
at that price.
And at that price.
At that price. I mean, this was a serious wine at that price. And I went, whoa, totally made me do a double take. And I nursed it over 5 days, and it kind of gave up the ghost at day five.
But that's, I mean,
that's extraordinary.
Yeah, that's crazy. And you could buy this at Chamber Street.
Chamber Street. Yeah,
David. I mean, that whole store. I mean, if there was one wine store on planet Earth,
that is a great store.
It's the great one.
The wine, actually, I did find out that brought in by MFW, and they do have other cuvées, and I can't wait to taste them. Very interesting.
They've got a great portfolio. I keep seeing that.
And Fronton, I love Negrette. It used to be a little simple country grape, Negrette.
Tell me about this wine. It was towards the end. Sylvain Bach, 14 Neck.
The Neck.
Grenache Noir. So tell me about the wine, but then I really want to talk about how it's made, because I kind of want to bore down on this idea of
okay.
So I'm an old guy that's drinking wine, and I've been to wine regions during the crush. We just got back from Bordeaux. We were in Bordeaux in September. We did Albarino. We've done Gamay. We were in Alsace, not during the crush. We were in Alsace and cellars tasting in May. We were on Mount Etna in June. I mean, I'd love to do this. And I've tasted like grape juice. I mean, like so amazing. So like it's still like alchemy to me. Like you're growing these grapes, and really good wine's just made on the vine. That's where it's made. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not plate. It's just not messed with afterwards, right? But I've tasted like the juice off the crush, and it tastes like grape juice. It's like there's nothing spectacular about it when you're literally tasting it. And then it's just this thing starts to happen with fermentation, how the fermentation's done, under what conditions, under what gases. Mm-hmm. Is there skin? Is there stem? Is it carbonic? Is it oxidative? I mean, we can talk about Chenon forever in Loire, how many iterations you're going to get from that one grape varietal based on soil. But so tell me about how this wine is made, because this is really interesting.
So you get a lot of this kind of geeky conversation in the firing line. So, and what we're talking
about. If you don't like this, stay tuned.
Like,
we'll talk about pastry next.
Right. It's like about carbonic maceration. What is carbonic maceration? Right. So it turns out in this village in Ardèche called Valvinière, which is about a half an hour from the Valence train station. It feels like I'm going into this little Brigadoon-like reality. Life stops, and inside, just this band of really natural winemakers who take it to another fervent step, almost, like they kind of have a guru, and the guru is Jacques Néaport, and he used to be Jules Chauvet's right-hand guy. So they all up there make wine in a certain way, which is a pretty religious kind of carbonic maceration. Carbonic maceration is basically when there's an enzymatic conversion of sugar to alcohol that happens inside of the grape instead of conventionally outside of the grape.
And we think of this, I mean, my first time seeing it was in Beaujolais, where it was really pretty much commonplace to see whole grape clusters, there's no destemming. There's no crushing of those grapes, which you see kind of everywhere else as standard Burgundian style or Bordeaux style winery. So you have whole grape clusters that are just thrown into stainless steel or cement, and the weight of the grapes themselves crushes the ones on the bottom. So they'll have naturally occurring yeast on them. The fermentation starts with them, throws off some CO2 as a byproduct, which creates this veil, essentially. And then you have this sort of microbe-like fermentation taking place. Enzymatic fermentation taking place within the whole clusters that sit on the top.
Yeah, which is probably the way we first found out that magic can happen to grape, because all of a sudden you have the birds getting drunk, or the people, if they drink it on the vine or have a grape from the vine that actually fermented. And within carbonic, there are all different ways. Now, the way they do it in Beaujolais is usually semi-carbonic.
Go ahead. Keep going.
So, and even in semi-carbonic, there are some variations. So you can pump in, so you, actually it usually starts by pumping in CO2 in a closed environment. And depending on how many days, sometimes, well, in the Beaujolais, you don't go through the end of fermentation. After about 5 days, you'll take it out, put in a vat, and it continues fermenting, usually still on the skins in a different vessel. Now, the way very few people do a full carbonic, and the way they usually work in the Ardèche in this one little village is full carbonic, meaning every day the wine is extracted from the bottom of the tank and put in another tank, and that happens until the end of fermentation.
And the reason is, otherwise you're not going to, if they don't do that, it's going to be really hard to get the alcohol high enough. You're really not making wine, right?
Well, that's not really about the alcohol, but it is.
Why do they do it?
They feel it's purity.
Purity.
It's the most pure way to have the least intervention. Because every day you're taking out the wine and it is finishing its fermentation in somewhere else, but is just very gradual, very gradual. So, and what you usually get from that kind of fermentation is a very fruity.
That's the point of it all. And you think of like Gamay Classic, that fruit-driven, high-tone fruit just whoosh. Right. Although there are even within, I think, Jean-Paul Blun, there's a few Beaujolais vintners that are making Burgundian-style Gamay.
Yeah.
Which is crushed from the beginning.
Crushed from the beginning, but even Burgundy used to make Beaujolais-like style, where at least it was full cluster and, you know, so not destemmed, full cluster, no CO2, but that always gives, whenever you have a full cluster and whole berries, you get those partial aromatics, heightened cinnamon, rosy aromatics. So, you know, even if you're working naturally, there are a million different decisions to make, and that's up to the vigneron to figure out how they're going to do it.
Yeah, Pascaline had a Loire Valley, I don't want to call it a seminar, it was an hour and a half tasting at Manhattan Wine Company last week. And at the time, she had one this summer that I literally drove from Cape May to Racine for lunch because she was doing a Cab Franc tasting and I drove home. So 7 hours in my car because Pascaline's a goddess.
Pascaline's worth it.
She's the best. And she's talking about Loire. It's like Pascaline unplugged, just like let her go. So she did a tasting and it was, I was at a Cab Franc seminar that she did. So that's the course of one of the red grape varietals that's sort of synonymous with Loire Valley winemaking. And of course, Chenin Blanc's the other one, so this tasting was a mix of both. But like the more I learn, the more I taste, the less so it seems like the less familiar I get, the less certain I am about anything in wine. Like the Loire Valley, I thought I kind of had Saumur and Chenin and Bourgogne. It's kind of parsed out, and I'm like, no way. Like it just depends on the winemaker and the decisions that they're making and whether that year. Yeah.
I'm the same way. The more I know, the more I absolutely do not know. It's incredibly frustrating. I feel like, can I just go back 20 years and really start learning about wine all over again?
So let's talk. Let's go back, because I wanted to, you know, your last point about the tasting notes, where things come from, that idea that you're getting this, you know, high-toned fruit. And so this is, sometimes we think of like clove and nutmeg and certainly cocoa and vanilla is coming from oak. I mean, that's kind of a classic American oak,
easier to identify.
It's slightly less dense than French oak. The wood's not as old. The trees aren't as old. But, so if there's oak being used, you're definitely going to get flavor components that are coming directly from the oak. We know that. But then, we're talking about a wine that never sees oak here that's got all of these. So these are like phenolic compounds, terpenes. What are they?
Well, for that, we're going to need Pascaline to come here and use really, really super technical, but they are phenolic, they are terpenes.
Right.
They are. It is And you can argue whether anything is coming from the soil or not, but certainly...
Well, this is the question. I mean, this is like this rhetorical question. Where is it coming from?
Well, up in the Ardesh there is some limestone. There's some basalt as well. And the effect of the soil is going to probably have the most effect on the acidity and the structure as opposed to the actual flavors.
Correct, because it's sort of... We kind of know now that, or they say that you can't, I mean, so wine's grown on slate, or wine's grown on granite, or wine's grown on chalky soil.
Right, which is exactly, as you know, the nature of the book that I'm supposed to be working on this very second instead of being here.
You're not supposed to leak that out. We're going to keep that secret. But they tell us we can't taste that. But yeah. Then I'm almost thinking it's like microbial terroir. Like, but there, sometimes, I mean... You can. It seems like it's present in the mouth.
Well,
it seems like it's coming from the ground.
I think that probably the easiest thing to feel and actually to taste. I know that I can taste a heavy clay soil in a wine. There's this cherry like density that is unmistakable to me, and there's a certain acidity. I don't think really flavor on a granitic soil, but I also know. For basalt, especially really heavy-duty volcanic basalt, I get an ashy quality.
You get smoke on the nose. I mean, you just get it. I mean, I was just on Mount Etna 3 months ago or 4 months ago tasting wine, and super volcanic, black volcanic soil ringed the whole way around. And, you know, those wines are sort of, some of the island wines are just unmistakable. Right. You pour them in a glass, and this isn't, I'm not talking about sulfur. I'm talking about, like, smoky, flinty notes of, and it doesn't blow off. It doesn't go away. These aren't, like, it's crazy.
And the thing that really brought Mount Etna home to me in this, does the terroir matter, if you taste Frank Cornelison's...
Yes.
Wine next to his grappa, next to his olive oil, that all come from the same soils, you're going to get a certain similarity, especially on the finish, on all of them. And where does that come from? And, of course, it's very, very fancy to have scientists just spend a lot of time trying to debunk the myth of the soil, and, like, it seems a very evil thing to do.
It's bullshit. If you don't believe in terroir, stick with beer and vodka. Do us all a favor. Don't drink wine.
But anyway, but I absolutely believe that it has a great deal to do. Of course it does, because the reason that Georgia peaches, it's not only the climate, but it's the soil, or why are the tomatoes better in certain parts of New York than others, certain parts of New Jersey than other, it's soil.
You had a really nice, you had a good shout out to Bordeaux here, this Pays Bon Homme, whatever the wine is called.
Yeah.
Right? From the Côte de Blaye.
Etipique.
Cab Franc, Malbec. And again, Chambers Street, $13 a bottle. How do they do it? Like, how can you... I don't understand how the... I mean, cork costs money. Labels cost money. Glass costs money. Well, a container costs money.
Chambers, when they do their direct imports, what they're doing is cutting out the middle guy. And we have this egregious system in this country, the three-tier system. And I know what people are getting ex-cellar, which means at the cellar door in France. And so a lot of people go specifically looking for wines that they can buy for 4 or 5 euros a bottle, which is crazy. And then you see those same wines on the shelf for $25 and $30. The winemaker isn't getting that. So at least Chambers Street takes a reasonable markup and their cost. And, you know, if we had more people working that way, and we could get rid of one of the middlemen, we would see more prices like that. So right now you go to France, you go to Italy, you pay one thing, you come here and you go, oh my God, it didn't used to be that way. There used to be a much narrower margin.
Interesting. And he does. I mean, he's got a Gamay. It's from Beaujolais, but I don't think they call it Beaujolais on the label because the guy doesn't want to deal with the whole AOC thing. Yeah. But he imports it, and he's selling this bio Gamay for like $18 a bottle. It's so delicious.
Ducru?
Yeah, I guess. It's like a handwritten kind of like artsy kind of label.
Oh,
don't ask me.
I know what that is. Yeah.
Doesn't make much, and the name doesn't make sense. The name is like a noun or a verb or something in French.
Yeah, so it's Vin de France kind of thing.
Yeah, but we know what it is. 100% Gamay from Beaujolais. It's by the guy doesn't want to deal with a whole AOC, like FU, whatever. Right. I'm making wine. I'll name it after my dog or my child or something, and it's delicious. And he brings it in, and he sells it for nothing. Give us a shout out again for the newsletter. It's a great, right before Thanksgiving, go there. I mean, just for this reason alone, it'll give you like so many choices at a great price point.
And it's a really good gift. How
there
about that?
Did
I give myself a plug? The Firing Line, Well, go to alicefiring.com, right. Hit the newsletter, or Google Alice Firing newsletter, and 8 issues a year, and it's really, really good bathroom reading.
It's great reading, period. She's got a great voice. She's been a proponent of natural wine since before it had a category name. Always a pleasure. Thanks so much for coming out. We're going to have to do dinner between now and Christmas.
Yes,
at some point, or Hanukkah, whatever the holiday of choice is.
New thread on the Gmail.
We both could walk to the middle, meet on the Bowery somewhere, maybe Rebel or something. Patrick will have fun with us.
Yes.
We're the new chef at Pearl and Ash. Maybe that's an idea. They got a new kid at Pearl and Ash.
They're really right around the corner for
it. I know. We should do that. All right. Thank you, Alice. We're not going to take any breaks. Liz, we don't need to take a break. So we're not going to take any breaks. We're going to go straight to my next guest because she's in studio. She's been so quiet this whole time. Ali, can I call you Ali? How do you prefer to be called?
Allie.
All right, and you got to just get really good. You can sit anywhere you want. Just get close to that microphone. That's the secret.
Call me Allie or Alessandra.
All right, Alessandra. I want to call you Alessandra for the time being. Are you into wine? Was that like thoroughly boring?
No, that was actually really interesting because I don't have very much knowledge of wine, so that was very educational.
You're just saying that.
No, I'm really serious.
Okay, thank you. I didn't know. You're really quiet, and I'm like, this has got to be.
I was taking it all
in. You're on the wine bus or you're not, and like my son is totally into wine now. You haven't met him yet, but he moved to New York 2 years ago. He's been eating it with me, of course. You know, you get dragged into the Darth Vader lifestyle of going to restaurants and slurping around, and he's just so, he's like obsessed with wine. I think one of the greatest days of his life. Besides his girlfriend when she moved in with him, was he got to have dinner with Pascaline Lepeltier, who's a master somm.
Oh, wow.
She's at Rouge Tomat. Pascaline's an old friend of mine. She's a genius. She's brilliant. And when Sean got to have dinner with Pascaline and I, he was just like, all of the questions that were unanswered in the wine world, he got
awesome.
To ask. Yeah.
That's awesome.
They sat next to each other, and we got blind taste, and he's still talking about it. Anyway, congratulations. This is so cool. So I got to meet you. I've known Thomas. I've known of him. I remember we kind of were about the same age. So I remember when he was in New York at various restaurants. Of course, Raquel was the last step with Tom Colicchio in the kitchen before he went out west and before he opened French Laundry. Then we filmed at the French Laundry. And right when he did the deal with Time Warner, it was like literally the same week that deal hit the newspapers that he was going to be involved with an East Coast restaurant. And it was going to be in Time Warner as they were building it out. So we filmed, and Sebastian Roussel was his pastry chef at the French Laundry then. He would then follow Thomas to New York, do the pastry. But I guess what I'm getting at is I've known of Keller Inc. for the longest time, have had some of the best meals of my life at Per Se. Bouchon Bakery you can't really argue, it's one of the greatest bakeries in the history of New York City.
Thank you, I'll agree.
But Keller, I mean, Thomas just sort of has this standard. It was like, I always think in my head, it's like, you know, as a chef, he was probably in his early 30s, and he had gone out to California, and the L.A. thing didn't, that was to Checkers, it didn't exactly work out, and you know, Raquel was a tough way to leave New York because it was kind of like, eh, you know, it wasn't the exclamation point. And it was just like he got to the French Laundry and just put the gauntlet down and said, fuck it. Like, either I'm going to go down fighting this battle one way, or I'm just going to quit. I'll just, I'll move to Hawaii and surf or something.
Absolutely. He was very dedicated to his vision. Absolutely.
Totally dedicated to the vision. And I remember when we were filming at the French Laundry, again, because I'm an older guy and I've gotten the, you know, I mean, as chefs, that's all we do is eat, talk about food, dream about food, cook, and go out to eat.
Yep.
Get up and do it again.
That's the life.
And then, like, summer vacations for me and my girlfriend, wife at the time, wife now, would be we would go eat at 3-star restaurants in France. That's what we did. In the 80s, it was just like that's what everybody did. You staged there, you ate there, you had your notebook with pictures of what the food looked like, and you came home and you tried to recreate it. And I remember when we were filming at the French Laundry, I think we were there for a day and a half, my cameraman pulled me over and said, so what do you think? And I said, this is the first 3-star Michelin restaurant I've ever seen in America. What he's doing now, and Michelin wasn't here then, and honestly, I don't think Michelin, I mean, I'm not going to take it away from anybody that's getting Michelin stars, but it's a global brand now. But I mean, that standard, what he was doing, I hadn't seen cooking like that done before in America anywhere. And it extended to the pastry. So talk about what got you into pastry. What drove you into this?
Oh, God. I just come from a family that's all about food. Big Italian family. My grandmother always cooked. My mom always cooked. And I always found myself in the kitchen. It was surrounded my life. It's no different than it is right now. Not much has changed. And a big part of it was my mom is Christmas time. It is literally 30 different kinds of cookies, 6 dozens of each kind. I mean, my house is just a cookie factory.
Right.
And it's just what I wanted to do. I would probably say I knew relatively early on, I'd probably say freshman, sophomore year in high school, I was set.
And baking.
In baking. I knew what I was going to do. Pastry chef. Always pastry. Never was that interested in savory.
So, get out of high school. Any college?
Went right to culinary school.
Went CIA, Johns
Hopkins. Restaurant school at Walnut Hill College. Really tiny school in Philadelphia.
Yeah, that's really tiny. Yeah, I mean, like, you're out from outside of Philly?
No. No, I'm born and raised in New Jersey.
That's what I thought. But you ended up there. That's funny.
It was a school that just piqued my interest for some reason. Yeah.
And out of school, so that you did a baking major there?
Baking major. I went for my associates. Okay. I worked while I was in school. I was working for Steven Starr at Continental,
He's huge.
Right across from Morimoto. Right. Yep, that's where I was. Came home, pretty much, you know, relaxed in the summer. Quite honestly, my parents told me I had to go get a real job. I couldn't just bake out of home. And I started looking in the city. First job in the city was with Richard Leach at Park Avenue. I was there for like 2.5 years.
Craig Kiketsu was the executive chef, I think.
I was still there when...
Who was it? Oh, Park Avenue?
Not Burke.
Yes. Who was it?
David Burke was still there when I first started.
That was a long time ago. Okay, yeah. Okay.
So...
And Richard Leach was in it. Was he at Porterhouse with Michael LaMonaco too?
I'm not sure about that, actually.
I've lost track of him. He's an old established New York baker. Been around for a long time.
Oh, he's phenomenal. Yeah. And it's... I had his book before.
Yeah, I think he worked with Charlie Palmer at one point or something.
Yeah, he is extremely talented. He was doing plated desserts that were, in my opinion, far beyond his time during that time. Just the complexity where everyone, it was essentially, you know, chocolate cake, ice cream, call it a day. You know, he introduced the tuiles, the sauces, the 17 different items on a plate, and people weren't doing that then. So I learned a ton from him. I learned solid work ethic. I mean, he was not the chef that gave you your list for mise en place and walked out the door. I mean, he was doing the same amount of mise en place as everybody else. And he was great. So I was there for 2.5 years. After that, I had always really liked working in the bakery aspect of it. And I was like, you know what? I applied to go work at Paillard, the original one that was up on 74th. I applied, no answer. I applied again, no answer. So I started dropping off my resume. Because then at that point, I was like, I'm going to work there. Damn, I'm getting a job. And I think I was annoying enough that I finally got the attention of his assistant. He finally called me in. He pretty much laughed at me that I wanted to work there because he essentially did not think I could hang with everyone else in the kitchen.
I mean, that's an old guard French.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Kitchen. Which made me even more want to work in that kitchen because for me, I didn't want to hear the idea of I couldn't do it or you didn't think I was tough enough to hang with all the guys. I was essentially the only one that was female and the only one who spoke English. So.
Yeah, Francois still has his heavy accent to this day.
Exactly.
I think the longer he's here, the less I can understand him. But he's a great baker. I mean, Francois Paillard is a baker to the bone.
Extremely talented.
Just extremely talented guy.
Extremely talented.
So you were, how many years there?
I was there for 2.5 years. About 6 months in, I was able to, same thing as I had to convince him to take the job there, to get the job. I told him I wanted to be a sous chef. Same thing. He laughed at me. He's like, what are you, crazy? I was like, I'm telling you, I will be your best damn sous chef. And I was a sous chef for a solid 2 years there until I was like, all right, it's time to learn, to try to go somewhere else new. You know what I mean? Change the scene. But
how did you get involved with Keller Inc.?
That was, so I applied to Per Se. I went from Paillard to working at Per Se.
Okay.
Quite honestly, at that point, I just wanted a big change and I wanted to challenge myself. And I mean, there was no bigger challenge than going to work for Per Se.
Yeah. I mean, it's arguably, I mean, on any given day, there are a handful of restaurants that vie for the title of best restaurant in New York City. And Per Se is in that list.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I was at Per Se probably 5.5, 6 years ago. At that point, I think they were still top 10. In the country.
They are.
World,
I mean, it's great. You can't really argue. I mean, Ryan Sutton can say what he wants, and I like Ryan. He'll be on the radio with me in a few weeks, but that review of Per Se was ridiculous unfounded, and he's had a thing about Per Se forever that I don't quite understand, but he's the only guy that I think everyone else is on the same page. It's amazing what they do.
It is absolutely incredible.
From
and
the front
I
of the house
impressed.
To the back of the house, the food's unfucking believable. The service is like performance art. It's just, it's an extraordinary dining experience.
It's the detail that goes into it
is
just something that no one could truly understand. You really, it's just, the detail of the food, the service.
Well, we were there. We were there a few weeks ago, you and I, touring the kitchen. And we went upstairs and met the bread baker, and been there, French guy, Alsatian guy. And he said the bakery basically is running right now 22 hours a day, probably going to go to 24 because why bother breaking it down and closing? That 2 hours you could use. And one of the things they were working on while we were there was whoever was in charge of like the cheese tasting menu kind of threw them a curveball. He wanted some kind of a bread that night to go with the cheese, just something different. So it's like, that's the kind of shit that they do.
Absolutely. That is a regular thing. It's actually the funny little battle of, chef, you don't understand. These things have to proof and make. And, you know, it's a savory mentality of, we'll just make it, you know. It always ends up being sort of an entertaining battle. But it's always, you know, our head bread baker, Francois, he really gets it and he understands it's a challenge. It's like, you know what? This is going to be damn impossible to make, but I'm going to do it. Yeah. And I'm going to get it done for service. And you're going to have the most unbelievable bread to go with your cheese course.
And it's not going to be the standard.
Exactly. And that's what it is about that culture. But
so when you were doing the pastry per se, Sebastian was the chef, Roussel?
No. He was gone.
He was Bouchon at that point.
Yep. Okay. So I, when I started working there, the current pastry chef that is there now, so Elwin Boyle, so he's actually the pastry chef for both, technically overseas, per se, and the French Laundry. So he's sort of the executive pastry chef now. So he had been there for about 6 or 8 months. And it was sort of during a difficult time. That was a transition. That was probably, he was hired from outside. He's English. And I was hired from outside, which was really uncommon, which is very uncommon in restaurants. You know, promoting from within is always what's encouraged. You know, it's somebody who's gone through the ranks as a chef de partie and then moved up to a sous chef and up. So it was kind of a funny time. It was essentially, you know, him and I trying to, we can do this. Like we're here, we were hired from outside. It is what it is. And, you know, we're going to make this pastry department amazing. And it was incredible. Yeah. It was, to see him grow and change also during that experience, he is probably one of the best restaurant pastry chefs that I know by far. He's incredibly talented. So
your day-to-day, so at some point you leave the, I don't want to say cocoon of per se, but it is this sort of oasis of culinary excellence that I always, you know, when I see guys working, it's like when you work for Alain Ducasse in one of his kitchens, one of his serious efforts, it's like, you're fucked when you leave because you'll never cook like that again anywhere.
Yeah.
It's like you have gotten so used to a standard that's so high. The bar is set so high and every day you're hitting these marks. And the fact of the matter is there's precious few other places on the planet that work like that.
Oh, absolutely. The amount of time that you put into something so tiny and individual. Yeah. And then when you turn around and exactly when you make the transition from per se, and then you go to Bouchon Bakery where, you know, you're cranking out hundreds, if not 1,000 cookies a day to, you know, and everything's on 60-80 quart mixers.
Correct.
Where we were utilizing
stand
mixers. You got to change sort of your mind frame. But to your
credit, I mean, I have to say Bouchon Bakery, and you weren't in the beginning involved, but I remember like that third floor thing opened up and every morning I work at a New York Athletic Club. So no matter where I was living in New York, my day would start at the AC, which is around the corner. And sometimes if I got on the scale and I was at a weight that I was happy about,
go treat yourself.
Isn't very often anymore. Yeah. I go over to Bouchon and just like have something. Cause if you've never been there, it's on the third floor. It's an open floor plan. There's a dining room there with, there's a hot side to it, but the kind of pastry kiosk is just like it's not a whole lot of stuff. You have those macaroons that are perfect, the Thomas Keller Oreo.
Butter,
sticky buns that just look like... But things, every single thing that's there is like the best version of it you've ever seen.
And that's our ultimate goal.
That's what it looks like.
And it's something really like what we talked about when we met last week. It's, you know, sometimes it's tempting to try to want to, you know, create the new and exciting thing. But our main focus is making the best of each thing we physically, we want to be the best croissant you've ever had. We want to be the best chocolate chunk cookie you've ever had. And that takes a lot of work and dedication and a constant amount of repetition for the staff and then making it over and over again. And it's, we always laugh every time we have a new chef de partie and they're on cookie station and the chocolate chip cookies look different from the first day they did it to 2 months in, you know, and we always tell them you sharpen your skills and it's the little things, even though the ingredients are the same and even the mixing speeds are the same and the times are the same, it's just not the same. And that's what we really try to promote is, It's not always about the new and exciting thing. It's about just doing the stuff that we do extremely well and constantly trying to make it a little bit better every day. So,
how many employees do you oversee? Because you've got the location that I'm familiar with, which is third floor Time Warner. That's busy, busy, busy. And you're doing brunch now, which must be insane. And then you open in Rock Center, a neighborhood that I travel through less. It's beautiful.
It's okay. Most
I
mean, New Yorkers right on do Rock's, travel through less.
Yeah, but it's the center of Manhattan. I mean, it's Rockefeller Center. And in a lot of ways, it's the ice rink. It's the tree at Christmas time. Yeah. And it's a beautiful plaza. I mean, the older I got, I think the more I just love the architecture, the feeling of that space. There's a certain linear musical quality to it. And you're right on that corner. You're in the old Balducci's.
Right on the corner. Dina DeLuca. Right. Yep. Literally,
so how many employees? How many people do you oversee between all the? And you've got Vegas,
Beverly Hills, and Yountville and Napa Valley. So I'm the corporate pastry chef, so I oversee that, and then also I oversee all the retail operations. So I mean, Time Warner alone, retail and kitchen, I wouldn't say they probably have about 50 to 60 employees. Rock Center about the same. Essentially, multiply that by five, and that's. Somebody's better at math than I am, but yes, that's essentially so much, what it is.
That's a big umbrella.
And it's nice. I get to go to the other property, the West Coast properties, go about four times a year. So just a touch base. Each location has its own pastry chef. So they have that nice support out there. It's really good because then I can just reach out to them and, you know, have a nice support system at each location. So it's more manageable than maybe somebody would think. I don't have, you know, essentially multiple hundreds of people contacting me asking for advice. But it is. It's definitely a big task for sure. But I love it.
With the holidays coming up, I guess, I mean, you sort of have to do special stuff. So doing a Thanksgiving thing.
Pies for sure.
Bûche de Noël for Christmas.
Bûche de Noël for sure. So pies, we're doing apple, pecan, and pumpkin. And then for Christmas, we have chocolate, Bûche de Noël. It's a triple chocolate, modern. It's got dark chocolate, Manjari mousse, black chocolate cake on the inside, salted caramel. It's heavenly. And then we're doing a sort of a more old-fashioned rolled one that's a hazelnut cake, and it has a coffee buttercream, crushed candied hazelnuts inside. So that's delicious. Gingerbread people. Decorated all cute with a little scarf, super.
No,
super
it's beautiful. So it's beautiful. I mean, your pastry, it's one of those as an industry lifer, like when I see quality, it just puts a smile. Like you go to that little display case at Time Warner and you just go, fuck yeah, that shit's just spot on.
I appreciate it. Yeah, no, we try hard.
It looks great. Really everything tastes great. Years and years ago, we used to stay at a little hotel in Paris. It was cheap. It was on the right bank, right around the corner from Place de Madeleine. It was Rue de Sèze. The address was Sèze Rue de Sèze. But it was around the corner from Fauchon. So we would get up early and we would watch them set up the. This was when. What's his name? The who was it? Come on, I'm terrible.
Pierre Hermé.
Pierre Hermé was the pastry chef, yes. Right? So it was the 80s, and it was like because there was nothing like this in America, and we just see this pastry coming out like what the f? Like the most like everything was out of a book. Yeah. Perfect, perfect, perfect. And you guys are nailing it.
Yeah, thank you. And that's what It's true. You see these things in other countries and you're like, God, why don't we have that here? And I'm just excited that we're actually able to bring some of that here.
Because of people like you, people like Thomas from the top down, a great organization. Thanks so much for coming on.
Well, Alessandra, thanks for having me.
Otherwise Ali Altieri, the head pastry chef for all of the Bouchons around the country. If you haven't been, go. It's one of America's great, great, great pastry kitchens.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming up. We'll take a quick break, and then I've got a couple of chefs coming on who are going to talk about what they do in Midtown in the space of Italian food. So stay tuned for that right after this. Folks, Mike Halimeko here. Everybody knows that great cooking really starts with great ingredients, and these days we have so many options to choose from. Well, I go back to the Cola Vita family brand for years, and there really is a Cola Vita family behind this brand. I got their story long after I started using their products. Back in the mid-80s, when I was the chef at the Ritz-Carlton here in New York City, one of the things you can do as a chef is order your own food. You do the purchasing, and we switched olive oils to Cola Vita. When I had my own restaurant down in Cape May, New Jersey, the Globe, for years, that's all we ever poured at the table. That's all I ever cooked with. And then when I started my PBS show in 1999, I thought, if I'm going to look after underwriting and funders, why don't I go after products that I actually use at home? that I actually cook for my family with and in my restaurant with. I've been working with them for 15 years with the PBS series and now with Heritage Radio. The Cola Vita family goes back generations in Italy. They make their olive oil from great sourced olives, traceable source olives, just south of Rome in Molise province, Abruzzo, which is where my family hails from. Since then, their family's moved here, so there's Cola Vita's living in Rome, Cola Vita's living in America. It's a great, trusted family brand. It's the olive oil I use, and I'd recommend you try it as well. So if you listen to the show, you know I am a wine lover. We get sommeliers here all the time. We get winemakers. I've been drinking wine with dinner since before most of you were born. And when you think of the great wine regions of the world, I mean, what comes to mind? Bordeaux, Burgundy, Champagne, Piedmont? Yeah, okay. Well, I just got back from Bordeaux. Was there for the crush for the 2015 harvest. And I was thrilled to see, A, how the city of Bordeaux has transformed itself. It's so alive. It's so beautiful. And the region itself is crazy. There's a whole new generation of young vignerons who are coming in, and they're not making your grandfather's Bordeaux anymore. Young farmers, young vignerons that have been there for generations, that know the soil, that know the grapes. And what grapes are we talking about? You know, we're pretty familiar here. Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, Cab Franc, Petit Verdot, Malbec, all of those grapes find themselves in these blends. But the new style of Bordeaux wines are super fresh, super young, super clean, meant to be consumed now, not cellared for decades, because really, who has a cellar? The whites are super great. I think they're super undervalued and appreciated. Semillon, Sauvignon Blanc, crisp, dry, all stainless. If there's a little oak integration, you barely feel it. And the reds come in all sorts of styles. You know, the left bank is a little more Cabernet Sauvignon heavy, a little more structured, a little more tannic. The right bank with more Merlot tends to be fruity, a little more opened up, receives you a little bit easier. But if you've been walking past that Bordeaux aisle in your wine store, stop and grab a bottle. From $15 to $35 is some of the best value on planet Earth. With wines that are growing in one of the great wine regions, vignerons that are passionate, they know what they're doing. Give Bordeaux a second shot. I love the wines. Hey, folks, welcome back. Mike Colomeco here. Segment number three, today's show. I'm so happy to have here in the studio with me the team behind a couple of great restaurants in New York City, Il Gatto Pardo, which has been around for a while. It's in the old Rockefeller Mansion on 54th Street, right behind MoMA. Beautiful dining room, great food. Gianfranco Sorrentino is the owner. His chef is with us. Vito, always a pleasure.
Hi.
Always a pleasure. And a more recent restaurant in their portfolio is the old Café des Artistes. Now it's called The Leopard. It's 67th Street in, of course, that gorgeous building. Steps off Central Park. Michele Brogioni? How do you pronounce your name, sir?
Yeah, Brogioni.
Hi. You're the second chef there. I think I was there in September or during the summer. I had a great meal. Anyway, why don't you guys introduce yourselves? I'll start with you, Jean-Franco. Talk to me about what got you into the restaurant business and background. I mean, you're from just outside of Naples.
No, I am from Naples. Naples city. I started 14 years old. I started to work as, we say, commis or busboy. I used to work in the summer to pay my studies. I worked in Capri. I started to work there. Then at 17 years old, I moved to England. I started to work in the Dorchester, another hotel there. I worked in Germany, in France, in Spain, in Greece. Then I worked in also the Four Seasons in Tokyo. And then I moved to New York. In New York, I worked as a waiter. I worked with Mickey Mouse at Epcot Center. Then I moved to New York. I was manager for Beecher. Then I opened up my first restaurant in the Museum of Modern Art. I was very lucky that the board of trustees trust me. And we opened up at Sette MoMA, which was in 1991. And I think it was, for me, an incredible experience. I still remember very well the day that we opened up. I went to the old MoMA. I took the Philip Johnson staircase. I turned left. It was the Starry Night by Van Gogh. Then the Water Lily. I opened up my restaurant. And I saw the menu. And I saw the parmigiana di zucchine, the mozzarella in carrozza, linguina alle vongole. And I started to laugh. I said, look, where are we now, you know, in the Museum of Modern Art. Then after MoMA in 2001, we opened up, me and Vito, we opened up Il Gatto Pardo, 33 West 54th Street. We opened up September 18, 2001, 1 week after the tragedy of the Twin Towers. It was a tough time. very tough. I remember for days and days I was outside looking for people. No one car was passing by. No one person was passing by. But slowly, slowly, New York picked up. We made it, and we became busy, busy, and busier. And then 4.5 years ago, we opened up the Leopard at Des Artistes in one of the iconic places of New York, the former Café Des Artistes.
And it's landmark, so you had to preserve things, get permit all the way, clean off that, because Café Des Artistes went way, way back. And, I mean, shit, when I got to New York in 1982, it had been here a long time then. And that was when you could smoke in restaurants. And that place, so they had that beautiful painting, and it was literally, like, smoke-stained. It was like one of those old, you can't fake that. And to clean that, I mean, that took you guys, that was like a whole separate budget that you probably hadn't anticipated.
Exactly. We have an insurance only for the murals. We don't own them anyway, from 1924 by Chandler Christie. Yeah. And I remember after we finished the renovation, well, before the demolition, we had to box the murals. A special company, for a restoration company, they came, they made custom-made boxes to preserve the murals. Once we finished and we had the tablecloths set up on the tables, we were ready to go. We were paying the rent. Those two ladies, they came to clean up the murals. They scaffolding all around with a small brush and a small piece of cotton wood. They start to clean it up. They took 4 weeks. And I was thinking, I'm paying the rent. I won't open up. Please do fast. But they did an incredible job. You know, they are more beautiful than ever. Actually, the first reaction of people when they came in, they saw the murals before and then after, they thought that we paint on top.
Because they're so bright. Yeah, they came to life. Yeah. Michela, how did you come to join the company? Where were you just prior to this, if you don't mind me asking?
We met with Gianfranco. We have a common friends. I was in the city for a different company, for a Russian company where I used to work for 13 years. And I was thinking with my wife, with the kids, to stay in the city. And I was start to look around what's going on, if I can find someone, some place in the city. And through a common friend, I met Gianfranco and Vito. And we start to talk together about the Leopard Des Artistes, that they would love to change some things. I was ready to this new challenge. And we find a common goal, so to bring a new light on this plate that we deserve it. And I think that we are start to making a pretty good job.
Yeah, it's a neighborhood institution. Again, you're around the corner from Lincoln Center, Café des Artistes. I mean, that Artiste location has been sort of the heart of the Upper West Side for a long time.
We have a nice client, this wonderful place, and honestly, wonderful company that's so close, so friendly, so...
And how would you describe the food? Because I don't want to put words in anybody's mouths. I mean, you're the chef de cuisine. You clearly sat down with Gianfranco and Vito to talk about the concept. But regional Italian, southern Italian?
Say that 85% is from south of Italy. But the first, our main reason is to have... to respect the product. So we brought all the nicest product that we can find from Italy, from the American market, but most of all, we brought from Italy. We try to respect the product as soon as possible, as we can, as the Italian kitchen is. So work on the product, not too fancy, but just work on the flavor, to respect the season of the product and change the menu as often as we can, and to brought a piece of Italy on the plate.
Yeah, that's one of the hallmarks of Italian cuisine, is it's ingredient-driven. It's not so much technique-driven. I mean, I think the less you play with things, sometimes the better off you are with great ingredients, anyway.
Yeah, what we try to make.
Vito, you've been quiet the whole time here.
Oh, I think so.
Okay,
like
don't
that.
Fall asleep on us. You can't do that. I know you're not cooking. You're probably thinking about service, getting back tonight.
Yeah.
So you're from outside of Naples.
I am from Salerno.
Salerno,
from Cilento.
Cilento, coastal town. Beautiful.
It's a beautiful area from Salerno. It's a national park, and it's a lot. That's where the Dieta Mediterranea was born. Where they find it, Cilento, Ciaroli, Pioppi. That's the origin of the Dieta Mediterranea, and that's where I'm from.
And you're, what I like about you the most, and there's a lot to like, your food speaks for itself, is you really seem to be like a chef. You enjoy what you're doing. Like, you get up in the morning and get to work, and it strikes me, unless you're really good at faking it, that you're really happy being in the kitchen. This is what you want to do.
Well, if you do it with a pleasure, with a respect, I think at the end of the day, when you go home, you feel satisfied. You respect what you do, and respect the customer. Customer, they come to eat, and you want to make sure they're happy when they leave the door. They leave with a smile on the door. And then when you succeed, and then when you feel better, and then the day after, it makes you even willing to wake up even earlier than that. To go to work.
He could see. We filmed you for the PBS show. I spent some time in the kitchen with you. I've been a guest at the restaurant numerous times, and it just really seems like these days, these young kids, I don't even know why they go into the business sometimes. You know, they're playing around with their smartphones and they're distracted, and I'm like, you're in the fucking kitchen. Like, put that thing away, you idiot. Like, just, you could always be doing a better job concentrating on the food. But it's like, all these people get into it for like all kind of the wrong reasons in a way. And then I see a guy like you that's just so old school, that just is, you're in your whites, you're happy, in the kitchen you're happy, the cooks are happy. It's like, it's the whole thing down the line. And you guys have been together for how many years?
Probably over 25 years. Sometimes
you go back to Beach.
Oh yes.
Since May 91.
Yeah,
so that's why I met Gianfranco.
So I like to say that I spend with him more time than I spend with my wife and my kids. Anyway, but you know what he said is very true. I mean, it's the respect of what you do, the passion you put in it. Our motto is passion is our main ingredients. You know, we have to enjoy, and all our staff has to enjoy what they're doing. They have to have a proud of what they're doing. Anyway. And that's, for me, the hospitality, anyway.
And you're, as a patron, as an owner, you're back and forth between the restaurants. You're in the front of the house. You've got a really strong front of the house, I think, because of that. Because it's not like you're at home at night at 5 o'clock watching the news or, ordering takeout. You're a hands-on owner.
Yeah, absolutely. And I enjoy what I'm doing. You know, my usually life is 8 o'clock, take the kids at school. Then I go to Gatto Pardo. You know, I stay there until late 9 o'clock. And then I take my Vespa and I go to Leopard and see what they're doing. By the way, you know that we open up another restaurant, which was the former Gatto Pardo.
Correct, down the street from you, which is a more casual version.
Correct.
And the name is?
Mozzarella e Vino.
Where 54th Street again.
33 West 54th Street. Yeah. So I pass by, I check it out, Mozzarella e Vino, then I go to the Leopard, etc. And then about 10, 11 o'clock, I am home when the kids, they are sleeping.
And how would you describe the food at Gatto Pardo in your words? Because obviously you and Vito work hand in hand. The menu changes. We have new seasonal things that are constantly popping in and out. But how would you describe the general vision of the restaurant?
Already the name means a lot for us. Il Gatto Pardo is the symbol of Sicily in the 17th century. You know, the Regno delle Due Sicilie, il Gatto Pardo Sicily, Regno delle Due Sicilie, Napoli capitale, and was the Campania, Puglia, Basilicata, Calabria, Sicilia, Sardegna. So we take inspiration from this region for our menu. When we met, me and Vito, the idea was to cook as our grandmother used to do. Of course, looking now's day, my grandmother couldn't afford the extra virgin olive oil, $200 for half liter, which we don't do anyway. But, you know, checking better the ingredients. As Michele said, Vito, in the between, we were at Sette Moma and Gatto Pardo. He went back to Italy, opened up an agriturismo where he had a few rooms, and he used to have land where he had zucchini, eggplant, cow, capretti, etc. So he has, and Michele too, they have an incredible respect for the materia prima, for the ingredients, for the product. As you said, the Italian cuisine is ingredient driven against the French cuisine, which is more cooking style and more technique. Exactly. So if you don't have the right ingredients, you don't make Italian cuisine anyway.
Yeah, that was always one of the, like, this sort of, I mean, the ingredients now in America have gotten so much better in the last 20, 30 years.
Oh, yeah.
But I think one of the disappointments of traveling through Italy is you would eat these wonderful meals, and you come home and you try to replicate them. And like, you know, the zucchini that someone picked that morning from their garden, or the wild fennel that's growing in Sicily in season, or the sardines that were caught right at the peak. Like, you can't. We didn't have those, so you try and make this Italian food back in New York, and it would just taste like shit most of the time, because the ingredient. I mean, it was really simple math. You know, if you start with one and add one, you don't end up going too far. But if you have amazing porcini, amazing whatever, yes, amazing those little vongole, you get along. Those little tiny ones you used to get along the coast for the Amalfi Coast. You know, yeah, for the clams, or you know, or the tomatoes that you see in the south. I remember the first time I was in Sarno, and I saw this San Marzano, the little farms, and what that tomato looked like on the vine, and then looked at the soil with the volcanic soil, and then the water table. I'm like, it's obvious, man.
Of course.
Yeah, this is really simple. It's like, yeah, it's just, and I have to say, kudos to you too. The wine lists are great at your restaurant. So you're really,
thank you.
Are you involved? Do you have a wine guy?
Yes.
Or you're
No, I am involved in the wine list for the three restaurants. Of course, when we change the menus with Michele and with Vito, we sit down, we taste the new dishes, and we start to drink some wines and see how we pair them. You know, we talk about that, and at the end, of course, if we have some kind of not the same idea, you know, I am the boss, I decide anyway. But it's a team job anyway, with the manager and the chefs.
So, I mean, both of these restaurants, and well, the third one, we'll have the chef here, but the, it's, I mean, I think we think of Italian food in New York in all sorts of ways. I mean, it's certainly, I mean, Michael White has his own little mini empire, and I think that it was a point sort of in the late 90s and aughts when Italian food really overtook French in terms of popularity and respect. I mean, hell, there was a time. Were you here when Brian Miller was a food critic?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it was really, when Brian Miller was a critic, I don't care how good your food was, if you got 2 stars running an Italian restaurant, you kissed the ground you walked on, because he just had a bias towards French food, and the kind of New York did, too. But yeah. But what I love about your restaurants is they're just really homages to how great Italian food can be in an old world way. And you used to talk about, like, grandmother style. It's not like the fancy, tweezery, new age stuff. You've got chefs that are hands-on, that do great work, great ingredients, that just... They're just great ways to experience great Italian cuisine in New York at either the Leopard or Gattopardo.
Yes.
So hats off to you guys for doing a great job. So you've been 6 months at the Leopard Cafe at Artiste?
Yeah, I'm the newest one in the company. I'm the young one.
Is he 21 yet?
I wish.
Maybe. I wish. I would like to.
Guys, thanks for coming in on this kind of rainy, balmy, 60-degree Thursday here. No, but really, keep up with what you're doing. I love the restaurants. Il Gattopardo, 54th Street, right behind MoMA. Just super, super old school, super delicious. And by old school, I mean that in the best of ways. It's just a menu that's familiar and delicious and delivers on the promise. And been to the Leopard, had one meal there with you. I'm sure it's going to be great. You have tons of talent. And Gianfranco, keep up the great work.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Places in New York for Italian meal with great wine and this thing called great service, because that's something that's really kind of waning these days. You know, the whole, as I sit here at Roberta's, they're going to get me started on service in Williamsburg, because they don't really, it doesn't exist. But that's, it's a new generation. Let them play by their own rules.
Yeah.
Guys, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Grazie. Thank you for having us.
Stay tuned next week. We've got another show before Thanksgiving, and you'll find out who the guests are by tuning in next week. See you then. Thank you, guys.
Listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.